Afghanistan 8 years after.
It's been 8 years. Why isn't it better? That's a fair question.
Fair question, General McChrystal? Maybe it's more like a bad movie.
Sir, our perimeter is collapsing. Alpha Company and Bravo Company cannot hold. Charlie Company is being overrun.
Broken Arrow! Broken Arrow! I say again! Broken Arrow!
Confirmed, Broken Arrow.
Broken Arrow?
That means that an American has been overrun, calling in every combat aircraft for support.
My God, there's no hiding it now.
Who else is gonna bring you a broken arrow?
No one called a broken arrow, as in this old Mel Gibson movie, but a bloody attack in Afghanistan over the weekend and the loss of 8 U.S. troops makes it harder to hide a military strategy in disarray and the parallels with Vietnam. Broken arrows leading nowhere on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Monday, October 5th, I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, John. This hour, it's Monday. That means we've got The Takeaway agenda for you, guaranteed to make you the most well-informed person at the water cooler. We're also going to get a recap of the big sports weekend from The Takeaway's Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen and some interesting new research about sibling rivalry and what's behind it.
But first, Andrew Bacevich, professor of international relations at history at Boston University. So we referred to Broken Arrow there a moment ago. How do Americans evaluate this weekend attack in Afghanistan? Is it Black Hawk Down humiliation or a tough milestone on the road to victory?
Well, it's impossible to say. I mean, losing 8 Marines does not mean that we are losing. On the other hand, had we killed 80 Taliban, that wouldn't mean that we are winning. The fact of the matter is that if this war continues, we will have many, many more days like we had yesterday.
And we certainly can't do this by the numbers. Professor Bacevich, stay with us. An interesting conversation coming up right now. Everything else you need to know this morning.
The head of the UN is condemning an attack on a UN office in Pakistan's capital. 5 are dead there. A suicide bomber disguised as a security officer hit the lobby of the food agency. And as we just talked about, American forces in Afghanistan suffered heavy casualties in fighting this weekend. 9 soldiers died in multiple attacks, including 8 in a single fight near the Pakistani border. This week, the White House continues talks on a request for more troops.
Also at the White House today, President Obama will surround himself with doctors to pitch health care reform. He's giving a Rose Garden speech in a few hours. The new Supreme Court term starts today. Key cases include a challenge to limits on corporate spending and political campaigns and a closely watched lawsuit seeking to strike down handgun bans in the Chicago area. Vaccinations for H1N1 or swine flu start this week. Initial shipments are small. They go to health care workers and certain at-risk children. And Wall Street dipped a bit on Friday, but it looks like it's going to bounce upward this morning. The Dow opens at 94.88. The S&P starts trading at 10.25. The NASDAQ starts at 20.48. Futures trading suggests a positive opening on Wall Street. We're having a debate over whether we should put more troops in Afghanistan or take them out and leave. The government is debating it, but listeners are sending lots of personal stories on the issue.
I feel so helpless to put in my voice when he wants to decrease the American troops in Afghanistan. Please decrease our troops and bring the boys home. They're boys. My boy was in Afghanistan. We're still trying to recover from that.
Where do you stand? If you have a loved one who's serving, more troops to Afghanistan or bring them out? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Call a broken arrow or not. Good morning, everyone. Well, is it time to call a so-called broken arrow in Afghanistan? American forces overrun.
One listener who said, if Russia can't do it, why do we think we could? But you could also say that about the British. The British couldn't do it either.
Back in the 1920s, the Russians were sent packing from Afghanistan. There's no serious discussion of a so-called broken arrow in Afghanistan,
right.
But certainly there is a debate about sending more troops, and you're a part of that debate. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We've been hearing your personal stories about whether there should be more or fewer troops in Afghanistan. It's a down-to-earth morning. Bloody attacks in Afghanistan over the weekend. 8 service members died in an attack on an outpost with 2 additional fatalities this morning. On Wednesday morning of this week, the U.S. will have been at war in Afghanistan for 8 years. General McChrystal wants more troops in the country. The Obama administration hasn't decided, and National Security Advisor James Jones faced some withering questions over the weekend on CBS's Face the Nation.
I think it would be a mistake to underestimate the importance of other elements of the strategy that were decided on in March. We do have a strategy. What General McChrystal has done is presented his opinion, of what he thinks his role within that strategy is.
We do have a strategy, says General James Jones on CBS. Rejoining us is Andrew Bacevich, professor of international relations and history at Boston University and author of The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. He joins us from Walpole, Massachusetts. Thanks, professor, for being with us.
Glad to be with you.
And Marvin Weinbaum, a scholar at the Middle East Institute and former State Department analyst on Afghanistan and Pakistan, joining us from his home in Ossining, New York. Good morning, Mr. Weinbaum.
Good morning.
Let me get a comment from you first. I mean, is it fair to say to James Jones, the National Security Advisor, that the Obama administration is dithering in Afghanistan while there these troop fatalities over the weekend?
Well, I think dithering probably is the correct way to put it, but only if this goes on for very much longer. It's fair enough to say that they ought to take their time in making sure that they're agreed on a strategy. But you can't extend this indefinitely, or even more than another few weeks.
Professor Bacevich, it seems like there's been a curious evolution in the discourse from Washington on what's going on in Afghanistan. We had Senator Saxby Chambliss on this program last week, seeming to suggest that the Bush administration's 8 years, or 7 years or so, were essentially a complete waste of time, that we're only getting around to what we're supposed to be doing in Afghanistan now. I mean, first of all, that's outrageous, if he even makes that implication. And secondly, do you think that's the case right now?
That we've wasted our time.
Right.
Well, yes, we have. In this sense, the Bush administration's initial response to the 9/11 attacks was to insist that a global war provided the proper template for thinking about how to respond to violent jihadism. And it began that war in Afghanistan. Obviously, then it shifted that war to Iraq, which turned out to be a mess, and now the war is shifting back again to Afghanistan. And I would say 8 years on, the question that really deserves to be addressed is not simply what to do about Afghanistan, but does global war make sense as the way to try to prevent another 9/11? And my own view would be that, given the limited operational success in both wars that we've achieved and how much it's cost us, no, war is not the answer.
Marvin Weinbaum, do you have a response to what Professor Bacevich was saying there?
Well, I think if you define that global war simply in terms of eliminating al-Qaeda, I would agree with him. But I think that our stakes now in Afghanistan and in that region are far greater, and I believe that that's one of the things that's not being stressed here now. There are consequences at this point in time if we change our position rather substantially in Afghanistan. There are geostrategic consequences. We are a world power. We do have responsibilities. We do have strategic partners. And I think for better or for worse, we're there, and we have to take those into consideration.
Oh, Marvin Weinbaum, let me just get a clarification then. The Obama administration has seemed to take great pains to suggest that, in fact, the focus in Afghanistan is narrow on denying al-Qaeda a safe haven in Afghanistan. You believe that's too narrow?
I believe that's too. I think that was a mistake. It was taken largely because, and they knew better, it was taken largely because that was what would be saleable to the American public for getting us or keeping us committed. But the failure to define that, I think, in its broader terms affecting our vital interests now makes it so very difficult to make the case.
All right. Marvin Weinbaum is a scholar at the Middle East Institute, former State Department analyst on Afghanistan and Pakistan. Also with us is Andrew Bacevich, a professor of international relations and history at Boston University. Both of you, I'd like you to listen to Senator Carl Levin, who's the chairman of the Armed Services Committee. He's on record saying he doesn't want more troops to go in, but here he's speaking about how that apparently is the request from people in Afghanistan, at the very least, to have their own army strengthened. Listen to this.
There was a Marine captain out in Helmand province who put it this way. He says, our Achilles heel is a shortage of Afghan troops. When I was in Helmand province just a month ago, we were told by the local folks what they want is their Afghan army to be strengthened. And the ratio of Marines to Afghan soldiers when we were down in Helmand province was 5 Marines for 1 Afghan soldier. That is exactly the wrong ratio.
So that sounds very suspiciously like the old Vietnamization program in Vietnam, Andrew Bacevich. If Carl Levin doesn't go for more troops, what's likely to be the result? And what would be the purpose of more troops if President Obama decides to go with General McChrystal's $40,000 recommendation or so?
You know, I think if we could sort of wave our magic wand and create an effective Afghan army and police force, that would be the most wonderful thing in the world. But it's not as if we haven't been trying to create an Afghan army and police force. We've been trying to do that for the last 8 years. The results have been very, very disappointing. You know, whether or not simply trying harder gives us different results strikes me as unlikely, especially given the fact that the recent Afghan elections really call into question the basic legitimacy of the government of President Karzai.
So yet another parallel
of a building bricks right. Without straw circumstance.
Yet another parallel with Vietnam. And again, I go down that road perilously. We don't necessarily look to history as an advisor here in Afghanistan. Marvin Weinbaum, do you have a sense that 40,000 additional troops could accomplish either the strengthening of the Afghan army or the nation building required to be of geostrategic significance here?
Well, I think the additional forces are warranted if you're going to pursue what is the very heart of the counterinsurgency doctrine, which is military only in part. It has other components involving creating better government, creating safe conditions where you can deliver development. Yes, the elections have created a problem, but I would take issue with whether we've really spent 8 years building the Afghan army. We really didn't seriously get started in that until just a few years ago. And here again, we've not had the trainers. The real problem here with the Afghan army is that at the moment that we seem to be stepping back, we seem to be questioning our own role there, it's going to become very difficult to be able to convince them that they have to make the commitment showing the loyalty to the U.S. and its allies. Just let me add one more thing
quickly.
Here. I think in general, any kind of suggestion that we now have second thoughts on this is that, having spoken to many Afghans now, is going to send a message that the United States is really looking for an early exit, and everybody ought to reexamine their options.
All right, well, then let's take a listen to this in the final seconds that we have here. Here's National Security Advisor James Jones, who went over to CNN to get some more withering questions on Sunday on the State of the Union, talking about what it seems to me is a lowering the bar of the possible goals in Afghanistan. See if you don't agree with me.
I don't foresee the return of the Taliban, and I want to be very clear that Afghanistan is not in danger, imminent danger of falling.
So Taliban does not return to power, and Afghanistan is not in imminent danger of falling. Is that an acceptable sort of definition of either failure or victory in Afghanistan, Andrew Bacevich?
Well, he also said, I believe, that the number of al-Qaeda actually present in Afghanistan was extremely slight. James Jones, in that excerpt, is making an argument that says that we should not plunge any deeper into this war. And I absolutely agree with that. Our larger interests in Afghanistan really are quite limited, and 8 years of war is plenty.
Andrew Bacevich, professor of international relations and history at Boston University, thanks so much. Marvin Weinbaum, I'll give you the last word. What is the definition of victory in Afghanistan, as far as you can tell, in the last few seconds?
Well, it's certainly not to win. It's to create conditions here where they will be able to stand on their own. That's really what we have to aim for.
And it's a high bar. Marvin Weinbaum, scholar at the Middle East Institute and former State Department analyst on Afghanistan and Pakistan. Thank you.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now, some quick takeouts on stories we're following this week. We're going to go to Washington first to talk to Todd Zwillick about health care. Todd, they finished it up in committee on Friday, and now we're supposedly going to get a vote on health care this week. Are we going to get a public option in this health care bill?
Oh, not so fast, Celeste. We get a vote this week in the committee. We're still a ways. Yeah, I know. This is the maddening slowness of the legislative process here. Tuesday, the Finance Committee is supposed to vote this bill out, and that's a foregone conclusion. But then this healthcare debate moves almost completely behind the scenes. Harry Reid, the majority leader, has to stitch together now this Finance Committee bill and the more liberal Health Committee bill that passed earlier in the summer. Meanwhile, over on the House side, that's the Democratic leadership over there is stitching together three bills. Capitol Hill in the next 2 weeks is like one giant sewing circle, really, stitching together all these bills, but it's not quite as nice as it sounds. The big question for Harry Reid is, will he include the public option in the bill that goes on the floor? Now, the Health Committee has a strong public option in their bill. The Finance Committee, as we've been saying, will not have a strong public option. So it's up to Harry Reid, which of these paths does he choose? Does he put it in the bill and let people try to take it out by amendment, or leave it off the bill and let Democrats try to put it on by amendment? He said the bill will have a public option. It's a question of how it gets on there. Max Baucus says you can't get 60 with the public option in there. So that's Harry Reid's choice. And it, in some ways, it may be a Faustian choice. Now, you mentioned, John mentioned at the top of the hour that the president was having doctors over to the Rose Garden today. That happens around 10 past 11. The president did weigh in on the behind-the-scenes legislative process yesterday in his weekly radio address. Let's give that a listen.
It was Saturday.
As we move forward in the coming weeks, I understand that members of Congress from both parties will want to engage in a vigorous debate and contribute their own ideas. And I welcome those contributions. I welcome any sincere attempts to improve legislation before it reaches my desk. But what I will not accept are attempts to stall or drag our feet.
Was it Saturday, John?
Yeah, it's Saturday. It's going to feel a little like an episode of ER at the White House.
Right. Well, he seems to be telling those Republicans, hey, you know, you can be at the table, or legitimate attempts to improve legislation are fine, but no partisan foot dragging. That's fine for the president to say. But the real issue are his own Democrats right now. Can Harry Reid get the 60 as he tries to stitch these bills together? If the public option is in there, there are some Democrats who right now say they won't vote for it. On the House side, there's a huge debate among Democrats. How do you pay for this bill? The House leadership wants to tax Cadillac plans to help finance the bill, you know, these really expensive health care plans. That's great, but Cadillac plans don't belong to the CEOs. They belong to union members. So there's a big Democratic constituency that doesn't want those unions paying for this financing.
Okay, Todd Zwillick, Takeaways Washington correspondent. Thanks, Todd.
Also in Washington, our next quick takeout comes from Louise Story, who's had to encamp down in Washington, D.C., because the entire financial industry is looking at Washington for guidance on regulation, et cetera. Louise, your colleague Gretchen Morgenson had in her column yesterday a suggestion that the whole question of bank health, the health of financial institutions, has been changed possibly forever by what Washington did during the bailout. How so?
Well, she had this calculation, John, of how much credit would be cheaper for the chosen banks, the banks who were bailed out. Mm-hmm. And listen to this. She found that the bailed out banks would be getting the equivalent of $34 billion in a subsidy every year. So that's every year this advantage for these healthy banks, the whales, as she called them. It's kind of like we're talking about public option health plans. It's kind of like a public option health plan only for the chosen bailed out banks.
Right.
And they've got this advantage.
So it really is like a death panel for
like
banks.
Like a death panel.
We decide who
you
lives.
You get bailed out, you're dead. But the other thing that's interesting, I wrote about this Inspector General report that's coming out today, where the Inspector General of the bailout is accusing the former Treasury Secretary of wrongfully calling these banks healthy. So last October, when they gave the bailout money to the top nine banks, Paulson came out and said, these are healthy institutions, they're taking the money for the good of the economy. And so the Inspector General is saying, hey, that was misleading, because we all know now Citi was in trouble and Bank of America was in trouble.
Well, healthcare.
So that's sort of an interesting.
Absolutely. Well, and you know, moving the goalpost is really what it's all about in trying to assess where regulation is going to come down if they decide to do this in the future. Louise Story, finance reporter for the New York Times, healthcare at the White House, healthy banks in the financial sector. Thank you, Louise.
And now to the takeaway, sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. Ibrahim, this must have been one of the weekends when you really love your job.
Yeah, there was a lot to watch.
A lot going on.
There aren't enough screens for what you had to do this weekend.
We're going to talk about football, but first let's talk about the amazing finish to the central division of the American League between the Minnesota Twins and the Detroit Tigers.
And the 1-1. Bouncing ball to second should do it. Polanco flips to Everett. One. That's a Tigers win. The Tigers, on the final day of the season, beat the White Sox, and they have earned, at the very least, a trip to Minnesota on Tuesday night.
Okay. Ain't over yet.
So they won 5-3 yesterday. The Tigers won. They wouldn't have done it without Curtis Granderson's amazing diving catch in the eighth inning, and that it literally wouldn't have happened. And meanwhile, Minnesota beat Chicago White Sox 12-4. So literally, that means they're tied now. So they play 162 games in a season. Well, now they play 163 games to make the season end on the perfect note in the Metrodome for the final game in the Metrodome.
Does this mean these teams are perfect? Matched?
That's interesting. They're not necessarily, well, let's think about their pitching matchup that's coming up this week. Rick Porcello, who's pitching for the Detroit Tigers, he's coming in at 14-9 with his record, and Scott Baker's coming in at 15-9. So actually, they're pretty closely matched.
You always do this. You deliberately put that in. The Minnesota Twins beat the Kansas City Royals.
Excuse me.
Before. Yeah, that's okay.
The Tigers beat the White Sox.
Yeah, Tigers beat the White Sox.
So the important thing about that also with the Kansas City Royals and the Twins is that they beat Zach Greinke over the weekend. And that he's the best pitcher in baseball.
Yeah.
So this weekend, everyone was looking forward to the New York Jets and the New Orleans Saints.
Boy,
who won
that
game?
The New York Jets did not win.
No.
They lost 24-10. They only did it with 10 points of offense. Literally, the New Orleans Saints did. They were the most explosive offense in the league, but they couldn't score. The way that they scored was because the New York Jets quarterback, Mark Sanchez, threw away 3 interceptions and 1 fumble. Two of those the fumble was a touchdown, and the interception was a touchdown by who? Darren Sharper, who ran it back 99 yards against the rookie quarterback for the Jets. It was an amazing game to watch Mark Sanchez's sort of dismantling wilting underneath all that pressure.
Well, you called it. You said they wouldn't win. And
technically, I did call it. Yeah,
you did.
Right.
Thanks, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, the Takeaway sports contributor. Coming up, we're going to get a look at the agenda for this week, all the news you need for the week ahead.
At least the Steelers won last night.
They certainly did, but they made it tough.
It was tough.
Yeah, exactly.
Nail-biter.
Good morning. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll get the agenda with a take on all the news stories that are going to affect the main headlines this week. That's in a moment. Right now, we'll check in on the top news stories at 32 minutes after the hour. American forces met tough fighting in Afghanistan this weekend. 8 died in a ferocious insurgent attack on Saturday. Another soldier died in separate fighting on Sunday. And meanwhile, 5 are dead after a bombing at the UN's food agency in Pakistan's capital. Several more are injured.
Healthcare workers in high-risk groups are going to get the first batch of H1N1 swine flu vaccine that's out this week. Thousands of acres have burned in Southern California's San Bernardino County. Governor Schwarzenegger has declared a state of emergency. And in Indonesia, they're through searching for survivors of last week's earthquakes. They're now focused on bringing aid to those survivors. Those are just some of the stories that we're following this morning.
Our government.
Iran.
Your government.
Proliferation.
Public option.
A serious insurgency.
We do have a plan. We're working on it.
Just to give you a sense of perspective.
It's Monday. Good morning. That means it's time to check out what's going on in the agenda this week. Joining us today is Marcus Mabry. He's the international business editor for our partner, the New York Times. And from Bush House in London, Jonathan Marcus, diplomatic correspondent for the BBC World Service. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So
Hi.
Let's start off in Iran. What we've learned from the International Atomic Energy Agency is that Iran is capable of making a nuclear bomb, but the agency is not saying whether or not they're building a nuclear weapon, and Mohammed El-Baradei says they are not.
The agency has no concrete proof that there is an ongoing weapon program in Iran.
Mohammed El-Baradei, the head of the IAEA. So, Jonathan, he says there's no concrete proof. What does that mean?
Well, it's an interesting assessment because there's been a lot of discussion in recent weeks and days about information that the International Atomic Energy Agency has. There have been leaks of various memos from the agency which suggest that Iran has made quite considerable progress designing warheads and things like that. Now, of course, the American administration said that it believes that Iran's work was halted in this area back in 2003, but there are a number of European governments who are rather sceptical of that, think that work might have continued. So at the moment, it's very uncertain as to exactly where Iran's capabilities stand.
So National Security Advisor General James Jones was on Face the Nation yesterday, and he had this to say about the inspections of the plant.
We now have an Iran that is willing to come to the table. We have two more meetings scheduled, one in which they will announce they will allow the inspectors to visit the Qom site, which has been just recently announced, and the other one to discuss methodology by which we can ship their low-enriched uranium out of the country.
So, Marcus, a little bit of a hopeful tone there that Iran is willing to let the inspectors come in as they're going to. Is that a good sign that Iran is coming to the table and allowing inspectors in so quickly?
Well, it's certainly a positive sign. The question is going to be, and we'll see how this week plays out, will these positive moves by Iran actually lead to a kind of dissolution once more of the American-led coalition that's looking to counter Iran? You know, the administration really felt that they had made great progress when the Americans, the Brits, and the French all came out together just a few weeks ago and said, you know, we have new resolve. We're going to draw a line in the sand. Iran will not cross this line. They will not be allowed to have nuclear capabilities. But with Iran coming out and saying suddenly, oh, well, we'll let inspectors in. Oh, we'll ship our used nuclear fuel to Russia. There's a question of whether or not this Western alliance can actually maintain itself or if they'll go back to what it was before the revelation of Iran's second nuclear enrichment site, which is basically a coalition that could not accomplish a whole lot and could not really bring tough sanctions against Iran. So Iran could end up benefiting, actually, from these kind of tactical moves.
Okay, so let's move to Afghanistan real quickly. You probably may have heard the conversation we had earlier and General McChrystal talking last week about 8 years and the situation there is not better than it is. And Marcus, how does the Obama administration then come to the American people and say, we need to spend millions, possibly billions more in Afghanistan after 8 years and no progress?
So that's exactly the challenge the administration faces. On the one hand, it cannot deny that the public support for this war is evaporating. 8 years, Americans are tired. We're an impatient nation, generally speaking. We've been there longer than we were in Iraq,
Eight years, of course. Impatient? I don't know.
Well, but at the same time, though, yeah. You're talking about an incredibly difficult country that has seen other great empires, from the Soviets to the British, crumble in its face of the resistance in Afghanistan. The problem here is, as the president said, if the goal is going to be to keep another terrorist attack from originating out of that country, to keep the Taliban from reinstituting themselves, Al-Qaeda from reimplanting themselves in that country, that's a huge, tall order. 8 years actually is not a long time to be doing it, especially as one of your earlier guests said. We actually haven't been trying to build up the Afghan forces for most of that time. So the problem is going to be, how the administration do you acknowledge the public evaporation of support and at the same time say to the American people, we are making enough progress that we should stay, and possibly even if we decide to, after our strategic review, increase our troop numbers. That's a really, really hard balance to strike.
Okay, so Jonathan, we have news that the Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao is going to North Korea to meet with Kim Jong Il. He went there over the weekend. Do we have any idea what the two of them were talking about?
Well, there are various trade agreements and other things, which is what you'd kind of expect. But I think essentially what the world is looking for out of this visit, it's the highest ranking Chinese trip to North Korea for many, many years now. And they're really looking to see what encouragement, I hesitate to use the word pressure, but what encouragement the Chinese can give to the North Koreans to return to talks with the key regional players, and obviously with the United States. The North Koreans want to have bilateral talks with the Americans. The Americans have pretty well accepted that you can have those sorts of talks within the framework of broader talks that would involve other countries like Japan and South Korea and so on. And the Americans are a little bit in a bind here. They want to move forward with North Korea. They want to explore what options there may be, but they're very conscious of the fact that they have to bring countries like Japan and South Korea along too. And in many ways, Japan and South Korea might be rather more sceptical about what can be achieved from these talks than at the moment. moment the Obama administration seems to be.
Is China interested in helping to North Korea to come back to the table to talk about its nuclear program?
I think ideally the Chinese would like the North Koreans back at the table. There's no doubt about that. The problem for China is it's a perennial one. I mean, the Chinese don't want a massive nuclear crisis so close to home. Equally, they don't want the sort of pressure on North Korea that might lead the whole country to collapse, and waves, a huge tide of refugees might flood across China's frontier. So the crucial thing, I think, is trying to get the message through to the Chinese that it's only through this concerted effort to bring pressure to bear on Pyongyang that any progress can be made. I think the Chinese get that message now. The question, of course, is how much pressure, how much influence they can really bring to bear on this rather extraordinary reclusive North Korean leadership.
Okay, Jonathan Marcus is the diplomatic correspondent for our partner, the BBC, and Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, the New York Times. So we always talk about family life on Monday, and today...
Brothers and sisters, feel fine. It's the time of your life.
Do you have the time of your life with your siblings, or is there a little bit more of rancorous fighting going on? We're going to talk about how to understand brothers and sisters, why they fight when they do fight, and how you can make those relationships a little bit smoother. That's coming up in 10 minutes. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Huckenberry. And we've seen over the last week just the vulnerability of island nations in the Pacific, the tsunamis in the Samoas, of course, Indonesia, and the horrible earthquake that they're still recovering from. Today, the Philippines is facing 1 million people displaced from a 1-2 punch of tropical storms over the weekend. Give us an indication of what the relief operations are like in the Philippines, Patricia Bermudez, is a sports reporter for Solar Sports in Manila. She joins us now, but she's become an aid worker like many people in the Philippines trying to deal with the million people displaced. Patricia, what's going on where you are this morning?
Well, you mentioned a million people displaced. It's actually 2 million people exposed to more super typhoons that are coming to the Philippines. So you can just imagine how frantic the work is at the moment because of Typhoon Ondoy, which really has paralyzed majority of the major cities in the urban areas of Manila. It has been very difficult. A lot of people that we talked to said it will take at least 2 weeks before they go back to their homes. People have been living in schools to take shelter. People have been living in other buildings, in old factories, and sometimes in a schoolroom. And mind you, schoolrooms in the Philippines are somewhat smaller than the schoolrooms in the U.S., or I can imagine in other parts of the world, but our schoolrooms house sometimes about 38 families, not individuals, but families in one room. So you can just imagine the kind of anarchy that goes on. These are people who are living in areas. There's one area that we have tried to help in the first 3 days of relief, and it's called Tumana, which lies right beside the Marikina River, which is a river that rose to about 30 feet at the height of the storm. They have about 38,000 people. So just in an area alone, you have 38,000 people that are still trying to put their lives together, but will really take and need months to put it together. So these are people who are lining up right now for food because they have nothing to cook with. They really have lost everything. And whenever you go out there and hand out food, cold hands are the ones that receive them because these are people who don't have clothes. All their clothes are soiled. All their clothes are wet. So they're waiting for relief. So you have men wearing blazers for women. You have men wearing cocktail dresses, anything that will keep them dry for the night.
That's quite a picture. Patricia, what are the tools that you have at your disposal for getting relief aid into the most affected areas? And we just have under about 40 seconds.
Well, relief aid right now is coming from all parts of the world, as I understand, and of course from the government as well. On a personal level, just me, a bunch of friends, and the people that I know have put our resources together to get clothes to help orphanages, because there was one orphanage that stayed in my house. 40 people stayed in my house because their orphanage actually went down under. So the kids have been staying at my house. We're trying to look for places for them. Everyone's really just pulling their personal resources just to make sure that the ones in need, the 2 million people who are exposed, will eventually have a comfortable life.
Patricia Bermudez-Hizon is a sports reporter for Solar Sports in Manila, talking about 2 million people exposed to the 1-2 punch of tropical storms in the Philippines, nearly 1 million people officially displaced from their homes. Patricia, good luck and thanks.
Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. John, you have four children, and I'm sure they never fight, right? Brotherly
never.
Love?
No, never.
I have one never. And only child, so obviously if he starts fighting with his siblings, it's time to get help. We're going to be talking about families as we do every single Monday, and today it's about how siblings get along or don't. We're also keeping our eye on Afghanistan. The debate right now is about whether or not we should send more troops or should we bring the soldiers home. I mean, we've been hearing your personal stories.
My brother Martin, who is a doctor in Massachusetts, and he, at the age of 57, joined the National Guard, and he's informed his family that he expects to get sent to Afghanistan or to Iraq very soon. And he did this because he believes he has to give something back to this great country.
Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Right now, here's a check on the top stories at 48 minutes after the hour. 9 American soldiers are dead after a tough weekend of fighting in Afghanistan. 8 died in a single militant attack on a post near Pakistan. And the UK's Daily Telegraph is reporting that Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has Jewish roots. The paper cites a photo of his ID papers. Ahmadinejad denies the Holocaust and is fiercely critical of Israel.
In the U.S., new research shows more children with autism than earlier estimates. The government now says 1 in 100 children are affected, up from 1 in 150 children. And 3 Americans are the latest winners of the Nobel Prize for Medicine. Their work has implications for cancer and aging research. And those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Pull out of the shadows and find them.
It's Monday. That's the day we talk about family on The Takeaway. Joining us now is Takeaway contributor Lisa Belkin. She writes the parenting and family blog Motherload for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning.
So today you're talking about siblings, and one of the things that caught your eye recently is some interesting research about siblings. What did you find in this new research?
Well, there's a wonderful book out called Nurture Shock, so I can't take credit for it. And it relooks at why our kids fight. And much of the research that is described here is, well, it's reassuring. It says don't get involved. You can't fix it. What you can do is help them fix it themselves.
Okay, so we're joined by Lori Kramer, Associate Dean of Academic Programs and Professor of Applied Family Studies at the University of Illinois, Founding Director of the Family Resiliency Center. She joins us from Illinois. Good morning, Lori.
Good morning.
So one of the things you say is that you can predict the quality of a sibling relationship before the younger child's even born, which would lend to this argument that parents can't change these sibling bickerings, right?
Well, you can predict it before the second sibling is even born, which I find absolutely amazing, but it really makes a lot of sense when you think about it. Young children have relationships with other children even before they become siblings, and it's the social and emotional competencies that children learn from these other relationships and demonstrate in those relationships that turn out to be very predictive of how well siblings are going to get along later on in life.
So
is it bad that siblings fight, or is it a part of their development? I guess, you know, sometimes the decibel level's a little high in my house. It's hard for me to sort through that, Lori.
Exactly. Well, it's not pleasant, that's for sure. And too much of it or too intense fighting is not good. So we're not talking here about fighting that's abusive, emotionally hurtful, or physically hurtful for children. But really, children engage in a lot of conflicts, as you know. And a lot of that actually does have some implications for children's development. Through fighting, actually, kids learn how to handle fights. They learn how to deal with a lot of the emotions that come with fighting. They learn some strategies for managing conflict. And in many ways, they learn about who they are and what they believe in.
So here's a situation that many parents and siblings may recognize.
Did you hit your sister?
Well, yeah, but...
I thought we told you that hitting each other is not allowed.
But she is constantly provoking me.
She does that on purpose, and you're a sucker for that every time.
So, Lisa, I mean, many parents recognize that. Kids, the older kid hitting the younger kid because the younger kid is purposely pestering the older kid.
And the father's pathetic analysis that is not helping. Also very recognizable there.
That's right. Everyone's been in that situation, right, Lisa?
No, I remember it, too, when my two-year-old looked at me and pointed to the infant in his car seat and said, Mommy, he provoked me. it starts early. It does make me feel a bit better to think in terms of what Lori was saying, that they need to do this in order to learn how to do this. Maybe that's the Zen mantra that can get some of us through. They need to figure out how to work this out, which doesn't mean they should be allowed to kill each other. But it does mean that we can't micromanage each bit of it.
But, is there a way for kids to learn what's a serious dispute versus a silly dispute? I mean, we get a lot of, looking at me wrong kinds of arguments, and I'm wondering
if that's... breathing the same air as
yeah.
I am.
You're right.
Yeah. You're right. Mm-hmm. What do you do about that? I mean...
You have to step in, right? I mean, you have to say, that's ridiculous, go back to your room and stay quiet, right?
Well, we have two psychologists on the line who have worked it out.
Well, we're joined right, Lori. So what's your answer? At some point, the parents have to step in and say, "Quit it."
You know, what's most important is that kids learn the skills that they need to be able to understand what's going on and handle those conflicts in a productive way. The thing is that we can't really expect children, especially under the age of 8, to figure this out on their own. So when we say, that we need to let them work it out, we need to be sure that they have the skills and tools to be able to do that. Otherwise, we're running the risk that they can hurt each other or that it's just not going to be a very productive experience for them.
Okay, we're also joined by Valerie Purdy-Vons, assistant psychology professor at Columbia University. So,
hi.
Valerie, we had that clip from The Cosby Show about the siblings hitting each other. And I'm wondering, this recent study focused mostly on middle-class white families who are based around the Urbana-Champaign area in Illinois. Does the nature of these sibling relationships change when you go to, say, a Latino family or an African-American family?
Well, unfortunately, there is not a lot of research in this area using different ethnic groups. Having said that, I was just at the Great Books Festival yesterday, and first of all, the dynamics of what a nuclear family looks like is really, really changing, whether it be transcultural, transracial adoption, older grandparents taking care of younger children. And so the dynamics, I would imagine, are going to change because what it means to have a nuclear family shifts. And some of the research I do, just asking kids who lives in the house with them, particularly African-American, Latino, and even Asian-American families, is a very complicated question for even 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. Having said that, I don't know of any research on ethnic differences in sibling rivalry, but there are lots of interesting findings about research on parenting styles that differ by ethnicity. One of the findings that many African-American and Latino families are the parents tend to be authoritarian. So a lot stricter, a lot more interested in rules, really kind of laying down the law. And so one could imagine that would have implications for sibling rivalry. Maybe, not so much of that. Having said that, you just showed the Cosby clip, so I don't know what that means. But one could see, you could see particularly in neighborhoods where it's not as safe, you really need to clamp down on children. And so that might wind up resulting in children that may not sort of argue that much, or at least in the same kinds of ways that was talked about this morning.
I would imagine that also when you start seeing shifts in socioeconomic status for families, that also plays out as a difference in how sibling rivalries and sibling bickeries is taken care of. Is that true?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, even in terms of who is, so the parents tend to always be the primary caretakers, or a guardian, or a grandparent, or aunt, or uncle. But also what happens is a lot of times in lower socioeconomic classes, older children are taking care of younger children.
Right.
So
they're always the peacemakers. Oldest.
Yeah, yeah.
Are, thank God for the oldest.
Yeah.
So says an oldest child.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, yeah. So that dynamic is also going to have an impact as well. I mean, they're just, this is such a fascinating and important area of research, and there just needs to be so much more that, you know, right here in New York would be just, you know, a huge adventure to see how this works out in terms of sibling rivalry.
Valerie Pretty Vons, thank you, assistant psychology professor at Columbia University. We also heard from Lisa Belkin, author of the New York Times Family and Parenting blog, and Lori Kramer, associate dean of academic programs and professor of applied family studies at the University of Illinois. Thanks to all of you.
I bet you guys have a story on sibling rivalry. Tell us at 877-8MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And also weigh in on whether there should be more troops in Afghanistan. A lot of you have been.
Does global war make sense as the way to try to prevent another 9/11? And my own view would be that, given the limited operational success in both wars that we've achieved and how much it's cost us, no, war is not the answer.
Your takeaway comes from Andrew Bacevich, author of The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. If you missed anything, we're always on here at The Takeaway. You can take our podcast to go at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
David Letterman has apologized, and the whole story sounds awfully familiar.
The creepy stuff was that I have
been unfaithful to my wife.
I violated the vows of my marriage.
Both of us committed acts of infidelity.
Had sex with
a dear, dear friend from Argentina.
Women who work for me on this show.
It's absolutely the worst thing that I've ever done in my life.
The difference is, this time, someone was watching.
I know what you did last summer.
Who's the bad guy here? The blackmailer or the blackmailee? You decide. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, October 5th. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry.
Good morning, Celeste. This hour, nuclear blackmail. What does Iran have to hide? Nothing or everything regarding nukes. We also have a story from Memphis, Tennessee about how a touchy social issue is playing out on the city's billboards. And we find out what the Supreme Court will be dealing with this year.
But first, Liz Shalit, partner at the law firm Lippman & Plesser. Back to Letterman. Can you avoid talking about sexual harassment when you have a case involving a boss and an employee?
Good morning. It's not easy. It's kind of like walking through a minefield. It might explode. It might not. The problem is that even if there is no claim of sexual harassment now, there could be a later claim of retaliation where somebody is denied an opportunity, terminated, or transferred to a position that they don't want, and claim it was because they broke off the relationship. Yes. So
it could be a ticking time bomb.
It's dangerous.
Liz Shalit, stay with us. We're going to talk about that in just a few moments. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, the United Nations chief calls an attack on UN food offices in Pakistan a heinous crime. Five are dead there. A suicide bomber disguised as a security officer hit the building's lobby. Nine American soldiers are dead after a tough weekend of fighting in Afghanistan. Eight died in a single militant attack on a post near Pakistan. And back in the U.S., also in Afghanistan, a partial recount of the contested presidential election starts today. It's possible President Hamid Karzai could end up in a runoff election.
And vaccinations for H1N1 or swine flu are available today for certain high-risk groups in the U.S. Healthcare workers are among those first in line. And President Obama is bringing doctors to the White House today to help push his healthcare plans. They're going to be with him at a Rose Garden speech in a couple hours. Wall Street dipped a little bit on Friday. The Dow's going to open up at 94.88. The S&P will start trading at 10.25, and NASDAQ will start at 20.48. The debate right now is over whether or not we should send more troops to Afghanistan. Some people are saying bring them all home, and we've been hearing your personal stories.
I think that we'd be better served to fight this war with more intelligence, special forces, and technology than trying to have all these troops on the ground. We we're just going to suffer a lot of casualties, and we'll probably end up like the Soviets.
That's Mike, who calls himself an Army guy. What do you think? Have you served overseas? Is one of your loved ones serving? And does that affect your ideas about whether or not more troops should end up in Afghanistan? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Good morning. We are following the story of Iran all this hour, looking at new information that says, well, it says the Iranians are capable of making a nuclear weapon.
They have the know-how.
If they have the will and the equipment. No. But we don't know if they, A, have the equipment and the materials to do it, or B, if they have the will to do it.
They've also agreed to inspections of the second enrichment facility and actually named the date. That's
right, pretty quick. But we're going to be bringing you more on that story a little bit later in the show. But right now we want to talk about the Supreme Court, because they start their term today with a very, very packed schedule. They're going to be talking about gun rights, dog fighting, the First Amendment, and this, of course, is Sonia Sotomayor's first day on the job. A lot going on. Dahlia Lithwick, Supreme Court correspondent and senior editor for Slate.com. So, Dahlia, tell me first, what are some going to end up being two of the biggest cases that the Supreme Court handles?
Well, certainly one of the biggest cases they handle, they've already heard. They had an extraordinary special session last month to rehear a case that was docketed for last term about the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform legislation. So that they reheard it. It was a really blockbuster session, and it looked very much as though the court is poised to dismantle some critical features of McCain-Feingold. As you noted, the other big issue the court just agreed to review is gun rights under the Second Amendment. They'd already decided, as you recall, to strike down the D.C. handgun ban a couple years back. Now a case comes up from Illinois that raises the question whether that Second Amendment individual personal right to bear arms that the court has found can be applied to the state. So really huge consequences potentially for handgun laws across the country.
That could be a major decision, because many states, I don't know the exact number, but I would imagine most of them have some kind of legislation in place dealing with where and when you can carry a handgun.
That's exactly right. I mean, it was a sea change when the court decided the Heller case. It was a sea change in interpreting the Second Amendment to not apply just to militias, but to, in fact, confer an individual right to bear arms. It was the first time the court had done that. It had been limited to D.C. because of a sort of a glitch in the constitutional system, because D.C. is not a state. So this question really now re-raises the question in a way that would impact state gun laws around the country. It's going to be a tricky line for the court to walk for exactly the reasons you lay out. They're going to have to essentially say, okay, what are reasonable gun regulations? And that's a hard thing to fashion for the whole clause.
It also, Dahlia, quickly raises the issue of states' rights. If the doctrine of states' rights conflicts with this sort of overriding Second Amendment principle, that could raise a lot of issues outside of gun laws.
Well, that's true. And one of the things that's been a real hallmark of the Roberts courts is that they've not been afraid to kind of trundle through some of the things that used to be sacred cows, like states' rights, like precedent, like the idea of stare decisis. This is a very, very strong court. I would go so far as to say quite an activist court, willing to sort of set back the clock on the Warren Court revolution, whatever it takes. So this is, I think, part of just a very clear progression we've seen since Sandra Day O'Connor was replaced by Sam Alito.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit about a couple of the financial cases, but since you mentioned Sandra Day O'Connor, over this weekend, she said that she regrets that her rulings are being dismantled. I can only assume she's talking about the campaign finance cases, the abortion rights. Do you know what she's talking about? Which rulings she feels are being dismantled?
She was speaking at a conference in Williamsburg, Virginia, and I've seen the same quote you have. I don't think she was much more specific than that, but it's really important to understand that Sandra Day O'Connor was the fulcrum of the Rehnquist Court. All those years that we called it the William Rehnquist Court, it was the O'Connor Court. And she was the fifth vote in almost every critical hot-button social issue in the country. She was the fifth vote on the church-state cases. As you said, she was the fifth vote on the abortion cases. She was the fifth vote on the free speech cases, the Establishment Clause cases, affirmative action. It was always O'Connor. And so in the time that she's been replaced by Sam Alito, who is not, I don't think anyone would say, the centrist moderate that she was, you've seen a real change, not just in the direction of the court, but a sort of systematic pulling apart of her brand of jurisprudence, which was very narrow, very focused, very case-specific. And I think one of the things we're going to see this year is one of the cases we haven't discussed yet is going to be heard this week involving a big cross on public government land. That's another area of the law that has O'Connor's thumbprints all over it. When can the state put up public displays that are clearly religious without running afoul of the Establishment Clause? That's another case where it looks as though the court is pretty much going to kind of thump over her life's work. And so I think she's probably reacting to abortion cases in the past, affirmative action cases in the past, and some of the cases, as you said, McCain-Feingold and religion that are coming up, in which it looks like all of her careful craftsmanship to broker deals at the center of the court are really going to go by the wayside.
Okay, so there's a couple important financial regulation cases. There's one that's a challenge to the 2002 law that was actually passed in the wake of the Enron scandal, in which they created a national board to oversee U.S. auditors. There's that one, and the court is also choosing to weigh in on the fees that a mutual fund's investment advisor can charge. And although that probably sounds like a little bit of a snoozer, that actually it brings up the question of, can the market system be relied on to regulate itself? So both of these cases seem to me relatively important in terms of financial regulation.
They are important, and they come in the wake of an important case that came down as a surprise last year, Clearinghouse versus Cuomo, that also gave greater regulation, greater power to regulate banks. So I think we're going to see a new court that's waking up and hitting the snooze button and saying, we need more regulation in this country.
Okay, we'll see how that happens, with Sotomayor having very specific ideas on criminal and corporate law. Dahlia Lithwick, thank you. Supreme Court correspondent and senior editor for Slate.com.
So you might say David Letterman produced some heat around the water cooler last week with his revelations of sexual affairs in the office, the exposure of alleged blackmail plots, and the public revelations of at least one former intern that indeed an affair took place, and in this intern's case, maybe it helped her career. Well, what kind of an environment does a situation like this create in the office? Can a consensual sexual relationship create actual hostility for other workers? With us now is Liz Shallett, a partner at the law firm Lipman & Plesser. Liz specializes in sexual harassment suits here in the New York area. Welcome to The Takeaway, Liz.
Good morning.
You know, this is a consensual relationship, so the traditional laws on sexual harassment don't necessarily apply, or do they?
Well, it is a very explosive situation because it's still unclear whether or not any of the women will come forward and say that it was a coerced relationship or that it was a quid pro quo situation where they were asked to provide, you know, get involved with this relationship in exchange for some kind of benefit, like getting on the air or something like that. But in addition, you do have the coworkers who may come forward and still claim that they were denied opportunities because they were not in a relationship.
They
didn't go for it.
Exactly. I mean, and these are discussions that are active in the office. Now, whether there's actually a body of evidence that can create a climate of hostility, certainly the fact that these things are talked about and people presume that relationships do bear on who gets promoted or not could, on the face of it, create a hostile situation in the office. True?
Yes. There's also the hostile work environment claim, and that is also a possibility if other women found what was going on offensive. I mean, if they were subjected to touching, kissing, or anything like that, it also could be evidence of that they were denied opportunities because they said no.
So, Liz, I mean, there's many workplaces have guidelines in your employee handbook saying that kind of deal with these issues of dating in the workplace, and very often dating between bosses and employees is highly frowned on at the very least, and there has to be good reasons for them because it leaves the business in a very murky situation.
Yes, companies deal with it in a number of different ways. Sometimes they have what is called no fraternization policies, where it's prohibited to have a intimate relationship with someone you work with, and particularly a subordinate. Sometimes companies don't just have strong anti-harassment policies, and sometimes companies have anti-nepotism policies.
Uh-huh.
Well, so, you know, they deal with it in a number of ways. There's lots of education. There's lots of policies. You know, the companies do their best.
But at the very least, Liz Shalit, it's clear that there's more to the story than simply, oh, Letterman is a progressive guy to sort of come clean with all of this, and we're in an era of disclosure now, period, the end. It's more complicated than that, right?
Absolutely. The women are in a really vulnerable position. I mean, this is a huge star, you know, wanting to have a right. sexual relationship with them. They are, you know, regular people who are given this amazing possibility of, you know, growth and opportunities, stardom.
Well, the details will come out. We'll find out if there are legal implications. Liz Shalit, partner at the law firm Lippman & Plesser, thanks for joining us.
Now, my response to that is, yes, I have.
Hey, you want that to go?
And now some quick takeouts on stories we want you to stay on top of this week. But we're going to take maybe a larger helping from Capitol Hill, where, I don't know about you, healthcare may be boring you to tears as it slinks along. The Senate Finance Committee, of course, is going to take a vote this
week. Sometime this week.
Then it goes on to the full Senate floor. But maybe others in Congress are finding other things to talk about. Here's Senator Evan Bayh, Democrat from Indiana, speaking on Fox News Sunday.
We are on a path toward a nuclear Iran, which is an unacceptable course if we're going to avoid the very painful dilemma of either having to live with that or taking military action to prevent that, which may ultimately be a choice we have to face. We need to act now on the financial and economic side.
Well, will they? Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, joins us from Washington. You know, Todd, the president on some level has really ceded the initiative on health care reform to the Congress in this whole, you know, sort of soap opera about health care reform. I'm wondering if there's some other issues that the president has unwittingly ceded the initiative to, like Iran. There was Senator Evan Bayh.
And the whole situation seems to have moved so quickly in the
yes.
last couple of weeks. I mean, right. usually with foreign diplomacy, these things kind of inch along. Then, of course, you know, we had the report that, you know, Iran's testing missiles. Iran has nuclear capability, maybe enough to make a bomb. And this whole thing has happened fast. Congress was setting about sort of the normal business of introducing bills to have sanctions against Iran several weeks ago. Now, as you heard Evan Bayh from Indiana saying there, that whole thing looks like it's moving mm-hmm. forward. There is a growing call, especially over the weekend, of members of Congress who want the debate over sanctions against Iran to be moved forward. I don't know that it would happen this week necessarily, although if there's enough pressure, they could get something on the floor quickly. There are bills out there. Yeah. But there is a growing call to get those sanctions, get those teeth in there
sure.
as the United States is talking to Iran. That's happening.
Well, we're beginning the week with enormous numbers of headlines out of Afghanistan, the 8 killed over the weekend and the 2 more killed this morning, U.S. troops, and then, of course, there's a bombing in Pakistan. You know, what is the status of this alleged showdown that Congress was teeing up, possibly trying to bring General McChrystal from Afghanistan to hold hearings before Barack Obama decided on his Afghanistan policy, which he's reportedly considering?
Yeah, I don't know how much of a showdown necessarily. Certainly it's a rhetorical showdown because some of the heavy hitters on the Republican side, John McCain, Lindsey Graham, have said they want McChrystal and they want him now to testify. But that's not so different from what the Democrats are saying. They want McChrystal to testify, too. It's all a question of timing. The Senate did vote in large numbers for a resolution last week saying McChrystal, Petraeus, come and testify. The only thing is they didn't say when. And that's where the whole debate is. They kicked the can on it. So, you know, Carl Levin, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, has gone around saying, look, when the Iraq surge was happening and we were all debating that, the whole thing was being discussed at the White House for two and a half months before General Petraeus came here and talked to us about it in the Armed Services Committee. There's no reason why McChrystal shouldn't have the exact same amount of time. So it looks, you know, Levin has the power to hold them off, and it looks like he probably will to give Obama the space to make the decision and then get McChrystal in front of the Congress and in front of the public to explain it.
Levin also made the distinction of the fact that Petraeus didn't come and speak to them until after the Bush administration had made their decision on strategy. Does it look like Levin is also going to make that here, that he's going to wait to bring in McChrystal until after Obama has announced a new strategy?
Unless the Republicans can find some extraordinary leverage with Carl Levin, and it doesn't look like they have it aside from going in front of the cameras and saying he should testify, well, Levin says says, yes, he should testify, but he's going to testify when the president has made his decision, not before.
All right. We've talked all about the kind of sand in the gas tank issues, things that indicate disputes between the White House and Congress. So there's a couple of things that are smooth sailing this week, though, huh?
Smooth sailing?
Well, unemployment benefits. Senate's probably going to extend unemployment benefits. There's not going to be a debate about that.
No, you're correct. A whole bunch of extended unemployed benefits were passed in the spring as the economy was really tanking. 13-week extension of unemployment benefits for some, 26 weeks for others. Those are now expiring. The Senate looks like it is going to add another extension on those this week, and also an extension on some federal first-time homebuyer tax credits. To spur people to buy homes. You know, there's a fear, even among senators who don't necessarily support extending tax credits for sort of private use, that if you get rid of those first-time homebuyer credits now, it could really tank the home buying market, and that's not the time to do that. So they'll probably extend that without too much debate. At least it looks that way.
So we're talking about sort of Letterman's revelations a minute ago and what that might mean in workplaces around America. Any sort of new revelations in Congress going to come up this week?
Oh, I think you might be talking about Senator John Ensign from Nevada.
Yeah.
Well, he doesn't have his own comedy show, but he does have an investigation going.
Some people think it is kind of his own comedy show, but I guess that's for another time. Senator Barbara Boxer, who is the chairman of the Ethics Committee, not to mention the head of the global warming effort in the Senate, has acknowledged over the weekend that, yes, the Ethics Committee is investigating Ensign now. Up until this weekend, or up until before the weekend, it was just kind of another senator who is involved in another affair. There were some wrinkles in this because his family had made payments to his former staffer, a woman named Cynthia Hampton, as possibly hush money. It depends on how you look at it. Now, the Ethics Committee apparently is investigating Ensign because those payments could violate campaign finance laws. She actually worked for his political operation and his PAC. Also, her husband was on Ensign's Senate staff. Ensign helped to relocate him to try to get him a job. And if he was dismissed, and if Cynthia Hampton was dismissed because of the affair, that could have implications under sexual harassment rules. Yeah. So,
what about Naomi? You know, the soap opera continues. Todd Zwillick, thanks so much. Takeaway Washington correspondent. A lot of quick takeouts there.
If this is a soap opera, they need new script writers. Yeah, last takeout comes from our listeners. We're still getting responses about that conversation we had last week about distracted driving. Definitely touched a chord there. The Obama administration has banned federal employees from texting while driving. Calls are growing for a nationwide ban. And meanwhile, you have been sending in your solutions to the texting while driving dilemma. Ricardo emails us at mytakeofthetakeaway.org. I'm an entrepreneur located in Stillwater, Oklahoma. You know how in airports, cell phones go into airport mode to restrict them from performing certain functions within the airport? Well, how about if there's a device that restricts texting within 6 feet of the device? And then those devices could be installed in vehicles voluntarily by people who use cell phones, and they may be used to enforce a no texting while driving law.
I wonder if that constitutes patent disclosure by Ricardo there. He's disclosed
there
that. He's got the patent now. On our website at takeaway.org, Trey had a suggestion. Obviously, this is a greater problem the less experienced the driver. So I propose the texting or cell phone use while driving be totally prohibited, except for drivers over 60. We can only assume that Trey is over 60. But someone else responded that only people over 60 should be banned for texting.
Another thing that's got people talking is Olympics. Someone said the Olympics would have been good for Chicago. It's too bad Chicago didn't get it. We're also talking about siblings today, how they can get along better, and we got emails about that. You can always respond to something you hear on The Takeaway at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
Good morning, everyone. Coming up, nuclear Iran. Does it have anything to hide? We'll talk about that in a moment. Right now, let's check in on the top news stories at 32 minutes after the hour. Wall Street is open and bouncing upward as expected. A partial recount of Afghanistan's contested presidential election is now underway. It's possible President Hamid Karzai could face a runoff election with his leading rival. And in the U.S., the first vaccinations for H1N1 or swine flu are available today.
President Obama is speaking with doctors at the White House today. They're going to be there as he gives a speech on his health care plan. Right now, one key bill awaits a vote from the Senate Finance Committee. New government research says more children may have autism than previously thought. The newest figures indicate about 1 in 100 children have autism disorders. The previous estimate was 1 in 150. And we now know the latest win is the Nobel Prize for Medicine. Three Americans won for the research on DNA. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
So it all sounded so cooperative. Listen to the voice of Mohamed El-Baradei.
We agreed that our inspectors will come here on the 25th of October to do the inspection and to go to Qom.
The city of Qom was the site of that second uranium enrichment plant that was disclosed within the last few weeks. Mohammed Al-Baradei says that there's actually a date for the inspectors from the IAEA to take a look at what's going on at that plant. It's all cooperative sounding, but there still is a serious dispute among intelligence officials and governments involved with Iran on the question of nuclear policy. Does Iran have the capability to make a bomb? David Sanger joins us, chief Washington correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. Good morning, David.
Morning, John. How are you?
I mean, it appears as though if the United States expected Iran to take a hard line here and refuse inspections, that they really played this wrongly. Even on this program, the IAEA ambassador from Iran was saying, sure, we'll have inspections immediately. Is there something I'm missing here?
No. Once the secrecy around the Qom plant, which was built under a mountain on a Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps base, was blown, that plant is basically not terribly useful to them. And the U.S. position at the beginning was they didn't think that they had gotten to the final stage of putting in the centrifuges, these, you know, big machines that spin uranium and enrich it. So by the time the inspectors get in there, which will be a month to the day after President Obama and President Sarkozy and Prime Minister Brown made the announcement about the existence of this facility, which was not a great secret to those of us who haven't, we knew there was a facility somewhere,
right,
not where. By the time they get to that, you know, that place is likely to be pretty well cleaned out. I mean, I'm not saying there's going to be a sports bar and big screen TVs on the inside, but
that would be news.
Suspect, yeah, you're not going to see a whole lot on the inside by the time they get there. The big question is, What about the facilities that would feed it? Because this facility by itself doesn't make any sense. You'd need a covert network feeding it.
I see. So, you know, on the one hand, Iran appears to be trying to drive a wedge between the U.S. and other allies who are supposedly trying to project solidarity on sanctions against Iran. First of all, have they managed to do that? And secondly, the Israelis and the French intelligence officials who broke this story last week that no, Iran actually has the know-how to produce a bomb, want to shift the discussion away from facilities and to this sort of murkier know-how question. What do you make of both of those things?
Well, the story that I think you're referring to isn't the French and the Israelis. The Israelis and the French have believed for some time. They've disagreed for some time, as I've reported and my colleague Bill Broad has reported, with the U.S. assessment that design work stopped in 2003. The news that we reported in the Times yesterday was that internally the IAEA's own experts have put together a report. It's about an 80-page sort of running summary of what they know about Iran. And they have concluded that Iran has all the knowledge now that it needs and designs that it obtained elsewhere, whether it was from AQ Khan, from Pakistan, from China, from Russian scientists, whatever, that they have put together enough knowledge to build a weapon. That doesn't mean that they're doing it.
So what's the takeaway there? I mean, you can drop a bomb on a reactor, but you can't drop a bomb on know-how, right?
That's right. That's right. And, you know, the Iranians have figured that out.
And how do when's the cutoff line? I mean, what they've basically said is they know how to build a bomb, but we don't know if they have the will or the equipment, right?
So they know how to build the bomb, and we don't know whether they have the will, and we do believe they have, at least for now, a small amount of nuclear material you could be converted to use for that.
So, I mean, at what point do we say they have the will to build a nuclear weapon and they've started building it?
You know, will's a very difficult thing to figure out, and usually you only figure it out in retrospect.
Right.
So, you know, we're all sitting here remembering the intelligence failures about Iraq, where we overestimated where they were.
Right.
But remember that before that were a whole series of intelligence failures where we underestimated countries. We had suspicions, deep suspicions, for years about Pakistan, but weren't sure they'd made the decision until one day we woke up and they did a nuclear test.
And Libya basically surprised the Bush administration with a lot of its nuclear revelations, right?
That's right, but they had the equipment, but they didn't know what to do with it. They had bought the stuff from AQCon, and I guess the instruction book was still written in Urdu because they had not even begun to assemble it.
So I guess on the other side, you can analyze this as, well, hey, the Iranians are being completely cooperative, that this is a sign of an intent on the part of the Iranians to actually develop a cooperative relationship with the U.S. and the international community, because Ahmadinejad is actually under some pressure politically in his own country.
One could hope. And, you know, that depends on what kind of inspections you're going to see. I've spent some time talking to the IAEA and to U.S. officials and European officials on this. And, you know, the easy headline is get everybody into the plant. But that is not really what they want.
Hmm.
They want to be able to interview the engineers. They want to be able to look at the blueprints. You know, for 3 years, the IAEA has been trying to get interviews with a guy who most Americans have never heard of, named Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. He is the head of what's called Project 110 and 111, which seem to be the military-related projects for nuclear in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
The Iranians have said he's not available for interview, and he never will be.
David Sanger, I hate to do this to you. Is it more complicated this week than last week, U.S. policy on Iran? Have the Iranians made it more complicated or less complicated?
You know, they have made it more complicated, but they're very good at this. I mean, you know, they've been around negotiating for 3,000 years. We've only had like 250
right.
years of this,
good.
Right? And they know how to drag this out, and it's going to be very challenging.
All right.
You know, engagement's a great bumper yep. sticker in a campaign. This is what it looks like in governing.
All right, David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, talking about Iran's nuclear program and what they have to hide. Coming up, the story of one Marine who put up a billboard in Memphis and found out it was a very, very disturbing sort of way of notoriety. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. We've been following this story all morning out of Islamabad. A bomb exploded there this morning in the lobby of the United Nations World Food Program offices. At least 5 people have been killed and several others injured. Earlier this morning, we spoke with Shoaib Hassan. He's a correspondent in Islamabad for our partner, the BBC. He visited the bomb site and told us what the scene looked like.
Well, inside the compound where the explosion took place, there was debris lying around, pieces of glass and some mortar. The police had cordoned off most of the area. A lot of security forces had taken control, but from a distance you could see clouds of smoke from the spot where the explosion actually took place. It looked very much like a disaster zone.
So Shoaib, we heard that the Taliban led an assault this weekend in Afghanistan that led to the deaths of 8 American soldiers. Have they claimed responsibility for this attack on the UN World Food Program offices?
Well, not at this moment, but certainly Pakistan's government is pointing its fingers at them. Pakistan's Interior Minister Rehman Malik briefly spoke to reporters about an hour ago, and he said that he suspected that the Taliban were involved. But he said that this would not slacken Pakistan's resolve. He said that the government was going to carry out its operations, that it's continuing against the militants, and there would be no negotiations with the Taliban.
And in fact, the Taliban's leader has threatened wider attacks.
Yes, he has. He spoke to reporters on Sunday. That's the first time he has given a press briefing, and he said that he would retaliate for the drone strikes that are taking place in Pakistan's tribal areas near the Afghan border. He said American troops and American forces would be targeted.
Yeah, he said they would target American forces, but why did they target the UN in this attack?
Well, we don't know if they did at the moment, Celeste. they haven't really claimed responsibility. We'll have to wait and see. Certainly, there are other militant groups in Pakistan who are capable of carrying out such attacks. But at the moment, everybody suspects the Taliban.
So the United Nations building, how fortified was this building? How was the bomber able to walk?
Well, that's the big question, as Mr. Rehman Malik said. It was a lapse in security, certainly. And the man was dressed as a soldier, and that is what how he was able to get in. He said he wanted to go to the toilet, and then he walked in and blew himself up. But he should have been checked, certainly. It was a lapse in security, and investigations are continuing at this moment to find out how that happened.
He was carrying 7 or 8 kilos of explosives on him at the time that he came in. Correct?
Exactly. So he was not searched properly. Maybe this is obviously a speculation that possibly other people were involved. Government is interrogating other suspects, but we can't say at the moment what exactly happened, except for the fact that it was a suicide bomber and he was dressed as a soldier. That's how he got in.
So Shoaib, quickly, what does this mean about the relationship between the people of Pakistan and the efforts to rout out the Taliban?
Well, I think it's going to be a destabilizing effect on the UN, and it's going to directly affect those people who have taken refuge across the country after the Pakistan's military operations in the tribal areas. It's going to have an adverse effect on the relationship between the people and the Taliban. They're going to feel that they're not getting what they need, and that is why the Taliban are going to be more unpopular.
Shoaib Hassan is the BBC correspondent in Islamabad. He joined us earlier this morning.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, the story of Tim Smith, a gay Marine who learned some lessons about defending freedom in a billboard campaign in Memphis, Tennessee. We're also keeping an eye on Afghanistan. The debate right now is over whether we should put in more troops or take them out and leave entirely. But we've been hearing your personal stories.
My name is Tim. I'm calling from New Jersey. I've served twice in Afghanistan, once in Iraq. We are done in Iraq. We need to get out completely. And then we need to move those troops from Iraq to Afghanistan and get out of there in maybe 2 years. If we don't do that now, if we don't commit these additional 40,000 troops to Afghanistan now, then we need to pull all our troops out now at once, because it's either now, all, or none.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org to weigh in on this important subject. Right now, here's a check on the leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. 9 American soldiers are dead after tough weekend fighting in Afghanistan. The White House is considering sending more troops this week. National Security Advisor James Jones tells CBS that strategy talks will go beyond mere force numbers.
It would be, I think, unfortunate if we let the discussion just be about troop strength. There is a minimum level that you have to have, but there's unfortunately no ceiling to it.
All this is a partial recount of the contested presidential election in Afghanistan starts today.
In Pakistan, 5 are dead after an attack on the UN food office in the country's capital. Food program spokesperson Nancy Roman says it's a major blow.
It's obviously a terrible tragedy, not only for the families of the deceased, but for the entire humanitarian community and for the hungry everywhere.
A suicide bomber disguised as a security officer hit the building's lobby. Back in the United States, the first H1N1 or swine flu vaccines are out today. Supplies are limited, so healthcare workers are among those getting it first. And the new Supreme Court term kicks off today. Big issues before the court include campaign finance law and handgun bans in Chicago. Those are some of the news stories we're watching.
Well, this week in Memphis, Tennessee, listeners are joining the Takeaway community, and they're already dealing with a story that's unfolding outside their windshields as they drive to work in the morning on billboards in Memphis. It's a story that has produced some painful discussions in that community, and we wanted to share that story with all of our listeners around the country this morning. Bianca Phillips joins us. She's a journalist with the Memphis Flyer and has been covering the story. Good morning, Bianca.
Good morning.
So, Bianca, a billboard campaign to promote disclosure and candor about homosexuality in the Memphis community produced some controversy. First of all, when did this begin, and what kinds of billboards are we talking about here?
Well, in mid-September, the Memphis Gay and Lesbian Community Center put up 5 billboards in support of National Coming Out Day.
Which is October 11th, right?
Yes, and they wanted them to be up for about a month. And one of those billboards featured former Marine Tim Smith, and he was in uniform, and it said, "I'm gay and I protected your freedom."
Let's before we talk about Tim Smith for a moment, and we have Tim with us, let's get a sense of the premise of the billboard campaign itself. The idea was to put people who have sort of prominent, responsible roles in the community up on these billboards and to disclose that they're gay, with the idea of reassuring the community, right? What other faces were on those billboards?
Well, there were 5 billboards. One of them had 4 local ministers who who support gay people. And it just it had these four ministers, and it said ministers in support of gay, lesbian, and transgender people. One had a lesbian couple, and it said, "We're married, and God loves us as we are." Another one had just a single gay man, and it said, "I'm gay, and God loves me." And another one had three kind of well-known straight allies mm-hmm. that said, "Straight supporters of gay, lesbian, and transgender people." And these were put up throughout, all across the city, in various locations. And the goal of the campaign was just sort of to, for one thing, to advertise the Gay and Lesbian right. Community Center, because they feel like they've been around for 20 years, but people still don't know they're there.
Well, certainly this raised an issue in the community, and one could expect that it might cause some heated debate and maybe even some controversy. But Tim Smith, honorably discharged Marine, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Tim, when your face appeared on the billboard, a particularly unfortunate consequence occurred. You really touched a nerve. Explain what happened.
Well, the idea was just to give back to the Memphis community and to speak out for all of the service members who are still serving, who can't speak out about their sexual orientation and raise awareness about that. However, in Memphis, which has a jaded history with the civil rights movement, but overall is becoming a more and more, I would like to think, progressive and accepting city, there are still some traces of misplaced ignorance and fear, and so that came out in a very violent, hateful act.
Well,
in
presumably,
the destruction of the billboard.
So yeah, so your billboard of all of the ones that were up in Memphis were actually destroyed. That one was destroyed.
That one was destroyed.
Now, authorities are investigating it as a destruction of property. It hasn't been classified as a hate crime. Do you think if people knew the actual details of your experience with the military and how you were discharged, that they might be more sympathetic to you? And if you could explain those details, I'd love to know them.
Well, I would certainly hope that we would be able to have a good discussion without a hateful exchange. Like you said, served honorably, and it was known for a while, for probably about the last 2 years of my service, that I was gay, but it was really a non-issue because of my job performance and because of the respect I had within my command.
And where did you serve, sir? Where did you serve?
I served primarily with VMFA AW-332 out of Marine Corps Air Station Beaufort, South Carolina.
I see. And as you say, for the last 2 years of your service, it was a non-issue. People understood your sexual orientation, but somebody decided to blow the whistle.
That is correct. A former head of the Chaplain Corps retired and became a local minister. And when I refused his help to enter a change ministry, he pushed my command to discharge me from the Marine Corps.
So wait a minute. A minister who suggested that maybe you should go to a change ministry that would presumably change your sexual orientation. These are very, very controversial ideas,
right.
Change ministries. But because you refused to do that, he outed you to the military, and then the military basically had no choice but to discharge you.
That is correct.
Well, I mean, I'm wondering if people knew those circumstances, if they'd be a little more sympathetic on the billboard.
I think that has been one of the things that we've tried to set the record straight for around here, because some people did not understand. They thought a minister necessarily broke vows or something of that nature. But like I'm trying to tell people, I was out to a certain degree, and that part was really the kicker in it, that it was a non-issue with my command until this minister made it an issue.
Mm. But do you have a problem then with the don't ask, don't tell policy? Because it is an issue. I mean, clearly once you were outed, the Army has this policy in place that said you had to be honorably discharged.
Oh, I take great offense at the don't ask, don't tell policy. There are so many wonderful people that I know personally and so many thousands more that have lost their careers and had their lives drastically affected by a policy that really has no place in the military and in the society we live in today. There's so much change, especially within the younger generation, and people that I've met younger than me, slightly older, I think it's being held in place mainly by a slight few at the very top who still have some misplaced fear and ignorance of
Well, fear of change.
A homosexual orientation.
Fear
exactly.
of change. Bianca Phillips, as you covered Tim Smith's story, and it's expected that this billboard will go back up, and we'll see what the consequences are.
It's actually already back up.
It's already back up?
Put it back last Thursday.
Who has been critical of this, and has anyone gone public with an idea that this is an inappropriate message in Memphis?
We actually had a big rally yesterday. The Gay and Lesbian Community Center hosted it at the First Congregational Church, which is an open and affirming church here in Memphis. There were about 250 people showed up. All the news stations and newspapers were there, and it's really been a big story here in Memphis, and I think that a lot of people showed up yesterday to show their support. So I think that the message is out there that it's not going to be accepted.
Well, it's not just a story for people in Memphis. The Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy is controversial within the Obama administration and around the nation. Tim Smith, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Tim Smith is an honorably discharged Marine. Bianca Phillips is a journalist with the Memphis Flyer who's been covering the story of those billboards in the Memphis area. And Tim Smith, you know, served his country, and he's gay, and that picture was too tough for some people in that community.
He did, and yet in the Memphis community, very often it's military and ex-military who had the most complaints about the billboard. They felt it was disrespectful.
Well, we want to welcome all of the listeners to The Takeaway who join us as of this week from the Memphis area. Thanks to all of you, and welcome. And if you want to take a look at that billboard and for more on Tim Smith, you can go to our website, thetakeaway.org. We have the picture up there. You can actually comment for yourself on the controversy there in that community. You can also go there to get anything you missed. Take our podcast to go at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes.
And we're also collecting your stories about Afghanistan and what you feel about the troop increase. Have you served there? Do you have a loved one serving there? Let us know. Should we send more troops? Should we not? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Tomorrow we're going to talk about office politics. Has it gotten worse since the recession? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway. Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.